You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with the editor of Think Africa Press, James Schneider. What's on the agenda today, James?
Nigeria's military might have killed more civilians than militants in its fight against Boko Haram. UK Prime Minister David Cameron has called on a common select committee to investigate The Guardian over the Edward Snowden leaks. And today is World Eradication of Poverty Day, and we look at how the perspectives of the world's poorest can be included.
Excellent stuff, James. Also on the programme... Yes, indeed. Money is at the center of coalition talks in Germany as the two main parties bargain over instituting a minimum wage. We talk numbers with the FT's Michael Steen in Frankfurt.
Plus, we preview this week's edition of The Urbanist and find out how to create a city where density works for the people instead of against them.
If you see each neighborhood having at least the types of services and cultural activities that would take place in a good medium-sized market town, let's say, you can then build the density up pretty high around that local neighbourhood.
And is there a new hunt for protesters that were involved in Istanbul's Gezi Park riots? Our bureau chief there, Sophie Grove, will tell us more.
All that and possibly some music too, ahead on the next hour here on Midori House.
So a busy Thursday edition of the programme, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Just hours before triggering an even bigger financial crisis, political leaders in the United States have agreed a deal on the federal budget. It ends the government shutdown and avoids a default on America's debts, which could have had a global impact. President Obama has welcomed the deal. He says he'll be speaking publicly about it again later today with some ideas on how to avoid similar problems in the future.
There's a lot of work ahead of us, including our need to earn back the trust of the American people that's been lost over the last few weeks. And we can begin to do that by addressing the real issues that they care about. But once again, I want to thank the leadership for coming together and getting this done. Hopefully next time, it won't be in the 11th hour. One of the things that I said throughout this process is we've got to get out of the habit of governing by crisis.
There'll be further talks between world powers and Iranian negotiators early next month after what's been described as the most detailed discussions yet on Iran's nuclear program. At this week's two-day meeting in Geneva, the delegation from Tehran submitted proposals designed to end the dispute over the country's uranium enrichment work. The EU's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, says all sides are keen to keep talking.
It was decided to convene the next meeting in Geneva on November the 7th and 8th. The participants also agreed that EU 3 plus 3 and Iranian nuclear, scientific and sanctions experts will convene before the next meeting to address differences and to develop practical steps.
Edward Snowden's father says the former US spy agency contractor has more secrets to share and should stay in Russia to make sure the true story is told. Lon Snowden was speaking at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York shortly after returning to the United States from a week-long visit to his son in Moscow. It was the first time he'd seen him since he was given temporary asylum in Russia earlier this year after leaking sensitive data on U.S. security agencies' operations.
He is comfortable, he's happy, and he is absolutely committed to what he has done. He makes his own decisions, and he's certainly living independently in Russia at the current time. So, again, given where we were in June, I can't imagine a better scenario today.
The United Nations says it needs more troops and equipment for its peacekeeping force in Mali. The force, known as MINUSMA, took over security responsibilities in July, but currently has less than half the 12,000 personnel which had been mandated. The UN Special Representative to Mali, Bert Koenders, said the force must have more resources to be able to stabilise the north of the country. And he said recent attacks by militants had been a wake-up call. A global index on modern slavery says almost 30 million people are enslaved worldwide. The Australian-based rights group Walk Free says slavery exists in all 162 countries it surveyed. Almost half are in India, where slavery ranges from bonded labour in quarries and kilns to commercial sex exploitation. The estimate of 29.8 million slaves worldwide is higher than other attempts to quantify modern slavery. The International Labour Organization estimates that almost 21 million people are victims of forced labour. The European Union has revived a proposal to charge foreign airlines for emissions over European airspace. Airline groups have reacted angrily, saying it goes against the spirit of a recent global aviation deal and could reignite trade tensions. The International Air Transport Association, which represents some 240 global airlines, issued a statement expressing concern and surprise at the proposal from the EU executive. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney Burnham. He'll be back at the bottom of the hour to update those headlines for us. Right, well, it is 16:06 in Tokyo, 11:06 in Moscow, and 8:06 here at Midori House in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda. We're joined in the studio today by James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James, lovely to see you. Where should we begin today?
Let's start in Nigeria.
And militants killing innocents?
The military killing innocents. Militants are also killing innocents, but there's a new report out by Amnesty International, and its research suggests that in the first 6 months of this year, the Nigerian military battling the Boko Haram Islamist militants have probably killed in their internment camps, in their prisons, more civilians than they have killed militants in fighting.
Is this something that's resonating with Nigerians as an issue?
It is, but it's a problem where there's a real lack of information. So it's taking place firstly in three reasonably remote states in the northeast. There's been a state of emergency. It's difficult for journalists to get there. And where people are being interned are essentially military camps. It's not regular prisons. And this kind of lack of oversight, no accountability, is starting to resonate and really upset people.
Even though the people that have been killed are those people who themselves have been, we hear, murdering children. There were 50 students murdered just the other week.
Well, the people who are interned are not necessarily members of Boko Haram. I mean, if already around 1,000 were killed in the first half of this year in prisons, that would suggest that just from people dying in prisons rather than being killed in any other operation, that alone has sort of decimated Boko Haram's reach, which it hasn't. So that really suggests that a lot of the people who are being imprisoned, and therefore a lot of the people who are dying in prison, really don't have anything to do with Boko Haram at all. They're just being caught up in large military sweeps.
Mm-hmm. So is this just a matter of good luck Jonathan and his government perhaps overreaching a bit too much when it comes to fighting this insurgency?
Yes, and I mean, probably, I mean, if this proves to be the case, probably a lot more than too much. I mean, he's tried to go for some drastic action now because, this Boko Haram issue has been getting worse and worse over the course of his presidency. But there doesn't appear to be, and this is what he's getting criticized for domestically, there doesn't appear to be a clear plan beyond we'll go in and we'll smash. There doesn't seem to be very much in the way of intelligence gathering, very much information actually known about who are the leaders within Boko Haram, what are the different factions within it, how does it actually function. And so it seems like, I mean, the way that you can act stupidly without information is through violence, because it's the way that you don't have to know anything about the other person if you bop them on the head. And that's pretty much how the Nigerian military has operated so far.
And does it lead to wider questions about perhaps the state of the judiciary in Nigeria? Are there people in prison that shouldn't be there, that aren't part of Boko Haram? Obviously there's brutality happening within prisons.
Yes, there very much is. But this is even at a stage before that. These are people who are being interned with broadly without judicial oversight already. I mean, Nigeria does have large problems with its judiciary, does have problems with bad prisons, people who are innocent who are in prison. But this is even a stage beyond that. This is a military action, and these people are being held by the military rather than in the normal court system.
And James, another very interesting story. Of course, we've been hearing about Edward Snowden, who's still in Russia. His father visited him in the country this week. And according to his father, apparently Edward Snowden may have some more secrets to start spilling.
Yes. So Edward Snowden, there's more to come, basically. And as we know, the UK and the US government are not particularly pleased about this. And yesterday at Prime Minister's Questions, David Cameron called on a select committee, he didn't say which select committee, should investigate The Guardian for whether they broke any laws or, quote, damaged national security in publishing the Snowden material, which is just the next step in the British government's attempt to really pressurise and intimidate, I would say, The Guardian against publishing this kind of material.
Well, and that leads us on to the second part of the story, which is Glenn Greenwald, who is the Guardian journalist that broke the Snowden story, has announced that he'll be leaving. Or rather, he didn't announce, it's been leaked that he's leaving The Guardian. And I think that that's quite pertinent, that actually it's coming out in that way.
Well, it was sort of leaked, but the leak was kind of from him in a conversation with the editor of BuzzFeed, and then it's come out in interviews yesterday. But this is a new project from Pierre Omidyar, who is the founder of eBay, who, it turns out, was one of the people who was approached to buy the Washington Post when Jeff Bezos ended up buying it. And he wants to start a new large-scale mass media. He's looking to put in around $250 million investment into it, alongside Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, who of Dirty Wars and Blackwater fame, and to promote investigative journalism, critical journalism. And he seems pretty annoyed by about the NSA spying and how the government has responded to the Snowden leaks. And looks like they want to set up a critical mass media news organization which will take on these stories.
And there aren't that many details yet about the news organization. May be online.
He has said it will be online and online only so far, but you're right, we don't have a name. It looks like it's incredibly early stages. They haven't talked about roles, anything like that.
But talking about David Cameron there, threatening perhaps potentially The Guardian with this parliamentary committee to look into whether the news organization broke any laws when it published the Snowden files, does that set a very dangerous precedent? Because in the United States, you know, we haven't been hearing anything where the New York Times was going to be investigated by a Senate committee. So does this perhaps set a very dangerous precedent from the Brits?
And, well, yes, and this is a point that Greenwald has been making since his partner David Miranda was arrested, that because Britain doesn't have the same codified rights, we assume that we have the same rights, but it doesn't have the same codified rights, that the government has a bit more leeway. In David Cameron says, well, I sent my national security advisor and the cabinet secretary to politely ask The Guardian to destroy material. But from The Guardian's telling, it doesn't really seem like it was that polite, and it was just asking. So yes, I think that, you know, very much David Cameron and the British government are taking a different and harder line approach than Obama's government is in America.
James, let's go on to your last story of the day. It's the International Day for the Eradication of Poverty.
Yes, and which is a UN set day, and the UN is using it to for two purposes. One, to get sort of one last push on the Millennium Development Goals, and also to talk about what comes afterwards. And so they're billing the day to bring in the perspectives and knowledge of those living in the most extreme poverty, which has been a real theme for the UN, at least in its rhetoric, for what comes after the Millennium Development Goals.
But remind us what those goals are.
So the Millennium Development Goals were set at the Millennium, and they are they're 8 goals, and they're for reducing essentially the worst aspects of poverty by 2015. And some of them are on track in some countries and some of them aren't in others. But a real criticism of that process were they were essentially dreamt up by Mark Mallock Brown, pretty much on the back of a fag packet, just him himself. And so they tried to make this process for what comes afterwards. It's sort of, what direction does international development go? What direction does ending poverty go on a kind of intergovernmental level, but also in terms of individual government policies? And they were trying to make it more inclusive. So that this whole process is supposedly including all the voices of poor people, the people that this process is meant to be helping. But it really kind of hasn't. Their voices have been crowded out and not really engaged with that much, although every process says we are engaging, we are setting up websites so anybody can say what they want and so on.
James, thank you. Very, very interesting stuff. That was James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Thanks for coming on the show.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be finding out why it's all about the money for Angela Merkel.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin. The time is 9:17 in Berlin. It's 8:17 here in London. Now, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been busy meeting with her counterparts to try and form a governing coalition. Her Christian Democrats party fell short of the necessary majority, so she's been busy luring others to her side. So far, though, it looks like the Social Democrats are her only option after the Greens decided this week that they wouldn't play ball.
But plans for the SPD to join Merkel are far from secure. The biggest stumbling block, their demands that she raise the national minimum wage in the country. Currently, there's no minimum employers must pay their staff, with some companies paying as little as $4 an hour. Well, it's a very different situation on other parts of the continent. Neighbouring France is a champion of minimum wage policy, not just at home, but it's given its 2 centimes where Germany's concerned too. Here's what our man in Paris had to say.
In recent years, there's been something of a war of words between Berlin and Paris. This is the level of competitiveness in the Eurozone's number one and number two economies continues to go in opposite directions. France is one of the 21 EU nations which does have a minimum wage, and the higher labour costs that result mean that French products keep getting more expensive whilst German goods keep getting cheaper. How, argue the French, can our companies compete with German companies when the wage in France, at perhaps €14 an hour, is as much as double as what a worker in the same industry in Germany is making? Well, a number of French ministers in François Hollande's socialist government have hit out at Chancellor Merkel, saying that in the absence of a minimum wage, her country has an unfair advantage and that Germany's labour costs are artificially low. This is not a competition about who can pay their workers the least, say the French. Well, one can only imagine what the German Chancellor thought of the lecture that France's industry minister, Arnaud Montebourg, was all of a sudden giving her in the run-up to her re-election bid, telling her that a minimum wage in Germany was needed to improve conditions for low-paid German workers. Well, it's unlikely that those remarks were very well received. The German Chancellor has turned this argument on its head, and she suggested that France take steps to get its own economic house in order and cut salaries, therefore making the Eurozone's number two economy a little more competitive. In fact, Germany would like France to go a whole lot further. There have long been calls for sweeping cuts to pensions, welfare and salaries, reforms the powerful French unions would be very unlikely to agree to.
That was our Tom Burgess Watson there in Paris to give us the French angle. Well, joining us now to discuss the issue of how the minimum wage is perceived in Germany and how it's affecting coalition talks is Michael Steen, the FT's Frankfurt bureau chief. Michael, welcome to the program. Angela Merkel is very hesitant about this minimum wage, and she perhaps has a very strong argument on her case, doesn't she? When you look at how strong Germany's economy has been and how it's really led the Eurozone out of crisis.
She's certainly proving to be a stumbling block in the negotiations. And it's also certainly true that a lot of Germany's economic success over the last decade has been about increasing competitiveness and, to some degree, wage restraint. But what's actually interesting is I think I disagree in saying that the minimum wage here would be the problem. The level at which it is being proposed by the SPD of €8.50 an hour is already well below what many workers are paid, and would put it sort of roughly, I think, around about the level of the UK's minimum wage. And there just actually isn't the evidence that introducing this kind of statutory minimum wage, where Germany is an oddity and not having one, that actually does necessarily destroy jobs.
Why is the Bundesbank against this?
Well, they raise the worries that hurt people who are already marginal on the labour market and find it difficult to get into work, and that they will therefore find it hard to find a job because they are going to have to enter the workforce at this level, and that will give employers pause to thought. They worry also that, say, small companies will think twice about taking on extra staff because there's then going to be potentially a bigger cost associated with that over time. I think the other classic objection is, of course, young people who obviously have little experience and therefore skills, and therefore there actually is an economic argument for paying them less until they've built up those skills. I think those on the other side of the debate who are more pro minimum wages point out that, for example, when the UK introduced the minimum wage in the late 90s, they added some exceptions so that you have a sub-minimum wage, a smaller minimum wage for people under a certain age, and that to a certain degree can then answer some of those criticisms.
Well, Michael, you just said a little earlier that, you know, this €8 minimum wage that could potentially come into force in Germany would be far below what most people in the country are actually making, so it wouldn't have that much of an impact when it comes to the competitiveness of the economic might of the Germans. So if that's the case, why is Angela Merkel so against the idea of having a minimum wage?
Well, there's a lot of this is politics, and a lot of it, and there's an element of history and policies. The history of it is since the Second World War, there's been a sort of consensus that the state stays out of setting wages. It's something that should be set between the employers and the workers, and that goes back to sort of bad memories of the Nazis taking over huge swathes of the economy. But Merkel, by opposing it, also slightly playing politics, because historically also it was trade unions and the left of centre who felt the state should stay very much out of wage setting, and they were big proponents of this model that exists in Germany of trade unions and then the employers' associations setting wages for certain industries. And that's her counter proposal, is basically that there should be lots of minimum wages for different sectors in different places, which would be the more classic model. But the only problem with it is that because of the way work is changing these days, there's a much bigger part of the workforce that's not covered by any kind of sector set minimum wage, and it's not clear that you'd be able to start introducing them in areas where there's no worker representation for, you know, say for hairdressers or in some cases people working in internet shopping warehouses, that kind of thing.
Michael, we're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for joining us on the programme. It'll be interesting to see whether Angela Merkel will be able to cobble together some kind of a coalition with the SPD. Interesting stuff. Michael Steen, the FT's Frankfurt Bureau Chief.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 15:25 in Shanghai, 10:25 in Helsinki and 8:25 here in London. And it's time now to check in with one of our editors from around the world. Today we head to Turkey to speak with our Istanbul Bureau Chief, Sophie Grove. Hi, Sophie.
Hi there.
Sophie, your first topic today is about an iconic building. Tell us the background to this story.
So this is a story about Hagia Sophia, which is one of the most celebrated buildings really in the world, and certainly in Istanbul, where it really towers over the landscape. But recently there have been plans mooted by several people in the government, and recently on Tuesday during Eid prayers by one of the imams of a nearby mosque in Sultan Ahmed, which is just the region that Hagia Sophia is in the middle of, said that he would like to see the building made into a mosque. It was a mosque, we should say, for hundreds of years. It was built in the year 360 as an Orthodox cathedral, and it was really the centre of Christendom for so many hundreds of years. But in 1453, it was converted into a mosque after the sack of Constantinople. So it was actually nationalised by Ataturk in the 30s. So that's really the most significant point. It's becoming this dialogue between the secular side in Turkey and then the more Islamic members of the government, very nationalistic too, who would like to see it being used as a functioning mosque again.
And this, Sophie, this isn't the only case where this has kind of been happening in Istanbul. There seems to be this growing movement. Of course, Gezi Park was another example of this kind of turnaround. Is this a real growing divide in Istanbul between people that want to see the more historical elements of the city preserved versus those that want to see it kind of shift in a new direction?
Well, I think that there's definitely a pride throughout the city on all sides about the amazing heritage here. But there is this new real polarization happening between the religious and the secular sides and this legacy of Ataturk. I mean, one of the main problems with the Gezi Park to begin with was the fact that a mosque was mooted to be built there. It feels to many of the secular people here that, you know, these founders of the Republic, you know, that their legacy is being undone. But we've seen a few mosques around the country being converted into, churches, Orthodox churches and Byzantine monuments that are mainly museums, because this was the great statement of equality that, you know, Hagia Sophia and other Byzantine churches weren't going to be converted, you know, into mosques or otherwise. They were going to be made into museums. And some of those are being converted into mosques, largely because they're needed.
Because they're not needed, you're saying? Well, is there a congregation for them?
Exactly. Is there a congregation for Hagia Sophia surrounded by mosques in that area of Sultan Ahmed? This cleric on Tuesday said that there was, and called on the government that's currently looking at a parliamentary commission on it to, you know, service the vast congregation. A lot of critics are saying they aren't there and there are other mosques for them to attend.
Sophie, we were mentioning Gezi Park slightly earlier. Now there's an ongoing hunt for people involved in those Gezi protests. Tell us about that.
Well, this is a recent and rather interesting story coming out that's looking at members of the state broadcasting company who were involved in the coverage of Gezi Park, and they were tweeting and, you know, really very involved in the sense that they felt so emotional about it, as so many journalists did. And there is a review going on looking at that and whether or not that their involvement there was criminal, because they were sort of coordinating protests or goading the protests on. So it really is a worrying development when you see this retrospective sort of criminalisation of journalists covering those protests.
Sophie, thank you very much indeed. We'll have to leave it there. That was Sophie Grove, Monocle's Istanbul Bureau Chief. Thanks very much. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we leaf through this day's Latin America's papers and we'll find out what it takes to bring life to our city streets in the week's preview of The Urbanist.
But before all that, here is Mr. Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Just hours before triggering an even bigger financial crisis, political leaders in the United States have agreed a deal on the federal budget. It ends the government shutdown and avoids a default on America's debts, which could have had a global impact. There'll be further talks between world powers and Iranian negotiators early next month after what's been described as the most detailed discussions yet on Iran's nuclear program. This week's meeting in Geneva, the delegation from Tehran submitted proposals designed to end the dispute over the country's uranium enrichment work. Edward Snowden's father says the former US spy agency contractor has more secrets to share and should stay in Russia to make sure the true story is told. Lon Snowden was speaking on his return to the United States from a week-long visit to his son in Moscow. The United Nations says it needs more troops and equipment for its peacekeeping force in Mali. The force took over security responsibilities in July, but currently has less than half the 12,000 personnel which had been mandated. A global index on modern slavery says almost 30 million people are enslaved worldwide. The Australian-based rights group Walk Free says slavery exists in all 162 countries it surveyed. Almost half of all slaves are in India. The European Union has revived a proposal to charge foreign airlines for emissions over European airspace. Airline groups have reacted angrily, saying it goes against the spirit of a recent global aviation deal and could reignite trade tensions. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney Burnham. He'll be back later to update the stories for us. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin and Phil Hahn. Well, now, how do you create a city where density works? One that isn't just a collection of residential towers, but is a livable, vibrant metropolis too. How do you get people to live happily in close quarters with lots and lots of other people?
Those are lots of questions, Georgina. I don't know. I don't think I could live.
It's my worst nightmare, actually, isn't it?
I don't think I could live very happily with many, many people in close quarters. I think two in the studios, even.
I think we're pushing it, possibly,
yeah, so
even at this level.
Left, so we have a bit more room, a bit more breathing space. Well, from urban master plans to housing regulations, much of what City Hall does is about making the bones of a city that works for as many people as possible. But huge infrastructure projects or even entirely new cities don't mean much if streets don't have life. Density, of course, should be a positive. Something that makes our urban lives feel easier and fun even. And this is what the Urbanist team will be looking at on this week's show.
In this preview, we meet John Thompson, chairman of architecture firm John Thompson & Partners, and honorary president of the London-based think tank, the Academy of Urbanism. As an architect, his practice has worked with cities to plan new neighbourhoods and regenerate others, as well as doing research into sustainable urban development. He spoke with the Urbanist producer, David Michon.
I think we first started talking about problems in the inner cities and often in problems in the peripheral estates around the inner cities way back in the 70s and the 80s. I think the point about density is there are good places and there are bad places, and they may technically be exactly the same density. The Academy of Urbanism, our mantra is space, place and life. And it's like cooking, really. You've got to get that balance right. You've got to get the magic balance between space, place and life that produces quality of life, that produces an economic driver to develop in this proportion and in this place and for people to come to work and live, play and visit. And most of our city experience is to do with working with historical cities at the moment, although there are new cities arriving more or less every day at the moment, mostly in China and in the Middle East, etc. And of course, the inherited city, the wonderful thing about the inherited city, it was all about interaction between people, social interaction, cultural interaction, governance, all of this took place in the urban core, which was built at the scale of, for the horse and the human being. And everything was eyeball to eyeball. Manhattan was built on a street pattern, you know, for horses and carriages. Its density is multiplied by probably 40 or 50, and it still functions as a great city because subtly the infrastructure has been put in place to make public transport actually work in the city, unlike other cities at the same density where nobody goes in public transport because there isn't any, or it's a social stigma, or everybody is driving their new symbol of wealth and status in China, which must be a motor car. And apparently recently there was a 62-mile-long traffic jam outside Beijing that took 11 days to clear. And after the second day, the word got out and all the street traders from the old parts of the city got out there and they were walking up and down this 62-mile-long traffic jam. And that is a result of density, you know, in the wrong place with the wrong facilities that leads to everybody being the wrong place and taking ages to get, you know, to where they want to go. Conversely, China is doing brilliantly at linking their cities with high-speed trains, and they're getting on with that very quickly. But because of the demand for the motor car, it makes a mockery of the density. I don't think many people have private cars in Manhattan, although there is a lot of underground car parking. So again, property values can help. If you can bury the car, you can get the buildings closer together, you get more street action, you get more life, you get more activity, more cultural things happen.
It seems as though it's really city hall and civic government which is responsible for providing that kind of base layer, providing the appropriate infrastructure, providing the regulations that allow for certain types of building and certain types of requirements of public space or for bike lanes on the street. Is that who we should be looking to? Is that who the pressure is on? Is it city hall who should be developing much more formalized ideas of how they want their city to be densified?
I'm just thinking of France, where all over the country, they still have centres for urbanism for the local area, where you get a mixture of professionals and people thinking about their cities. And a lot of the, I was in Marseille recently, which has undergone tremendously good improvements from a pretty poor base 5 or 10 years ago. They do have a thinking team for the city and the region, advising cities and towns within their municipality. In the Chinese system, it's like a ladder. It goes from one place to another place and it gets signed off. The original vision is sort of agreed to politically, but then it goes through a mechanical system. And at one point when it goes through planning, our schemes get Chinified. The streets all get 4 lanes or 8 lanes rather than, you know, smaller. And urban squares disappear because all the buildings have to face south if they're residential. So you suddenly get everything lined up facing south in one direction. And it's compartmentalized. And that's one of the reasons that we created the Academy of Urbanism over here, was to make sure that we got highway engineers, we got politicians, we got architects, we got landscape designers, we got water designers, etc., together in under one banner, which was space, place, life. And I think you have to keep coming back to looking at density and really thinking through whether everything is in the right place for people or whether it's actually in the most inconvenient place. And yet that's not the way a plan for a new city or town is necessarily judged by, let alone smaller incremental developments around the edges of market towns, etc., and peripheral development around, for example, around Istanbul, which is going to be hit by a mega earthquake pretty soon. They're building what they call very proudly their mass housing projects, and they're high density, they're construction projects, they have very little infrastructure, social and community infrastructure. They will have a school, they will have some shops, a big supermarket, but they're stranded on the outside of the city. What they ought to be doing is building another city, polycentric neighborhoods, you know, linked by good public transport with walkable neighborhoods where people get to know each other. And they're virtually, you know, on these peripheral housing estates around Istanbul, there are no pavements. You get the edge of a development, and then there's the road because nobody's going to walk between the developments.
What are the keys then to that might underwrite a neighborhood which you would consider to be of good density, a good quality of density?
Well, I think first of all, you want to say what do you want to be able to walk to? Wouldn't it be nice to walk to? Normally, there are schools within walkable distances. There should be local shops. Everybody accepts the fact that you will use the car to go on specific journeys, specific places. But if you see if you see each neighborhood having at least the types of services and cultural activities that would take place in a good medium-sized market town, let's say, you can then build the density up pretty high around that local neighborhood. And as long as you connect that neighborhood to other neighborhoods and into the city center, you then get self-contained but overlapping places in which people can know each other, they can grow their own identity, they can have their own celebrations, and you can start to build a community spirit.
That was John Thompson there speaking to Monocle's David Michon for more urban success stories. Tune into The Urbanist this evening, which premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours if you happen to be in my hometown, Toronto.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this in search of El Dorado.
For the November issue of Monocle, we head north, to the high north no less, for a special Arctic-themed edition. We set sail on icebreakers and Alaskan ferries, take a look at Nuuk, a gander at Gander, and meet a certain man in red who's gearing up for his busiest day of the year. And there's lots more too.
In the affairs section, I meet the cardigan-clad foreign ministers of the Arctic Council as they do diplomacy, Arctic casual style. We look at Greenland's fight for independence, and we see how Santa Claus is flying the soft power flag for Finland.
In the business section, we head to Helsinki to meet a company that designs and tests the toughest ships on the high seas, icebreakers. And we find out how the thawing north may be a boon for Finnish yards who make icebreakers. And we head to Burma to see how a new cadre of entrepreneurs is descending on Yangon to open restaurants, bars and boutiques.
So don your goose down for Monocle's special Arctic report. The November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how to join the club. You'll feel on top of the world.
Monocle's latest collaboration with Comme des Garçons results in a light, energizing and refreshing unisex perfume. Titled and inspired by Japanese cedar, Sugi. It has top notes of Mediterranean cypress and pepper from Madagascar, a hint of iris from Florence, and cedar from Virginia. With a bottle designed by Monocle's own designers, Scent 3, Sugi, is the long-awaited addition to Monocle's fragrance collection. Available in all five Monocle shops, Dover Street Market in London and Tokyo, and of course, online at monocle.com/shop.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 8:42 here in London. We go now in search of El Dorado.
El Dorado is a legend that's long enchanted Europeans. Some believed it to be a lost city made of gold. Others think it to be the story of a man covered in powdered gold who plunged into the Lake Guatavita in Colombia. Bringing over 300 artefacts from the Museo de Oro, the Gold Museum in Bogota, the exhibition Beyond El Dorado, Power and Gold in Ancient Colombia, seeks to uncover some of the truths surrounding the legends.
Well, it opens at the British Museum today, October 17th. We sent our own Colombian import, Andrea Alarcón, over for a sneak peek yesterday, where she was able to catch up with the lead project curator for the exhibit, Elisenda Villa.
The British Museum has a long experience of bringing like archaeological pieces and pieces of high value, historic value across the world. But in this case, of course, we were dealing with quite a special material in terms of the jewelry pieces and the size of them. And we're very lucky, very fortunate to have been able to have the support and the sponsorship of American Airlines, who were able to help us in the transport of these pieces by some of the ceramic and stone pieces going into their cargo flights directly to London. But at the same time, the gold pieces were carried with hand luggage, with special cases made for the objects, and then were carried with individual couriers for each case, and they were traveling in first class. So very well protected and guarded throughout the trip. This exhibition entitled Beyond El Dorado really wants to explore that, to go beyond the myth created by Europeans, by Westerners, about this person first that was fully dressed in gold and he became a ruler and after that became a whole city, a whole kingdom made of gold, clearly none of those existed. It was just a myth constructed by Westerns, by Europeans. What we want to explore in the exhibition is the reality behind the myths, the rituals that really took place throughout the Colombian landscape in pre-Colombian times, and how people expressed their identity, their status, their power, how they communicated with the supernatural, and how they transformed themselves throughout this range of objects, some of them made in gold and other metals, and some other materials, very precious materials to them. All the pieces throughout the exhibition, as you know, they're made of an aleation of gold, some natural occurring silver, and copper. So a symbolic mix in each one of the objects. The value of gold in pre-Hispanic time was not a monetary value, it was more a symbolic value. And gold itself was associated with the sun, this powerful creature in the sky, where copper was more associated with silver. So in a way, each one of these pieces merges this contrasting opposite day and night, male side related to the sun, female side related to the moon, in each one of these objects.
Would you tell me, please, about the actual ritual of Guatavita?
Yes, one of the chronicles, Fraile, who was born in Bogotá, actually, tells about one of the rituals that he thinks is El Dorado, and he links very much to El Dorado. And that ritual takes place in a specific location in the landscape, in Lake Guatavita. And he talks about this ruler, this leader, that is taken into a raft at the center of Guatavita Lake. And he's placed there dressed from head to toe in gold powder and with gold adornments, while all the people cheer and sing and dance in the shores of the lake. And he goes with his attendants into the center of the lake, into this raft. And when he reaches the center, a banner is raised, everything goes into silence, and then all the attendants throw these baskets full of gold and emeralds. But what is interesting, that's the Western conception of what was offered. Excavations on the lake show us that there were all these other range of materials, very important to pre-Hispanic people, that they were also offered together with this gold and emeralds, for example, ceramics, stone pieces, and probably textiles and featherworks and other organic material would have been offered to the gods that they have not survived in the archaeological record. But we have a few examples here in the exhibition that we can show to the public to show this great diversity and this richness of materials too.
All of the gold pieces of the museum were found in Guatavita, or where do you know where they were found?
Well, most of the pieces that you'll see in this exhibition were found in tombs, and that's quite important because these objects were used by high status people. They were given rank and identity within the community and a status within a community to the person, but they were also used for a transformation, for a physical and a spiritual transformation of some of these initiated leaders to transform themselves into powerful animals that have some of the qualities that humans don't have. For example, in jaguars, that they have this night vision, this extra strength. They are great hunters and they prey on their enemies. And for example, birds, that they have the power to fly and to see the world in a very different perspective. What is interesting that power that you obtain during life, or that status that you obtain during life, is also maintained in the next life, in the afterlife, when you die, because life doesn't finish there. There's a continuity. And you want to take your objects that create your identity and give you this power into the next life. So all the objects that you'll see in the exhibition, except the ones that were offered to the gods, like the tunjos that were offered to Lake Guatavita and other locations in the landscape, all of them were found in tombs, in burial practices. So they were taken for the disease in the next life to become maybe from a human to an ancestor. You know?
Anything that would have been in the actual lake was probably taken by the Spaniards when they got there.
Over the centuries, there were many attempts to drain the lake, to source all this gold that, you know, the legend tells that it was thrown into the waters of the lake. And chronicles mention the amounts of gold that was taken from Lake Guadavita, and this was just one of the many lakes throughout the landscape where rituals would have been taking place, and one of the many locations, because they would have been rivers and they would have been caves and so on. So just in this lake, to think about the amount of gold that might have been taken gives us an idea of how much gold was used in ritual practices throughout, you know, the territory, the Muisca landscape, to offer to the gods, because you offer to the gods what is most precious to you, and gold was very precious and very sacred to these people, and that's why it was offered to them.
And that was Alessandra Villar speaking with Andrea Alacon on the new Beyond El Dorado exhibition, which opens today at the British Museum in London.
Well, it's 10 minutes to the top of the hour here in London. We're going to be having a leaf through this morning's Brazilian front pages in just a moment. But before we do, we have time for one song. And our next guest, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, joins us in the studio. And he's actually going to introduce it because his Portuguese is a little better than mine.
Shall we listen to some classy samba?
Let's do it.
Phil and Georgina. We're going to listen to Chico Buarque with Você Não Ouviu.
Você não ouviu o samba que eu lhe trouxe. Ai, eu lhe trouxe rosas. Ai, eu lhe trouxe um doce. As rosas vão murchando. O que era doce acabou-se. Você não ouviu que eu lhe trouxe. Ai, eu lhe trouxe rosas. Ai, eu lhe trouxe um doce.
As rosas vão murchando. O que era doce acabou-se.
Você me desconcerta, pensa que está certa, porém não se iluda. No fim do mês, quando o dinheiro aperta, você corre esperta e vem pedir ajuda. Eu lhe procuro, mas você se esconde. Não me diz aonde, nem quer ver seu filho. No fim do mês é que você responde. No primeiro bonde vem pedir auxílio.
Você não ouviu o samba que eu lhe trouxe. Ai, eu lhe trouxe rosas. Ai, eu lhe trouxe um doce. As rosas vão murchando. O que era doce acabou-se.
Você diz que a minha rosa é frágil, que meu samba é plágio, é só lugar comum. No fim do mês sei que você vem ágil, passa um curto estágio e eu fico sem nenhum. A sua dança vai durar enquanto você tem um canto e não tem solidão. No fim da festa de escutar meu canto e vir correndo em pranto, me pedir perdão ou não.
Você não ouvi.
Ai, eu lhe trouxe rosas. Ai, eu lhe trouxe um doce.
As rosas vão murchando. O que era doce acabou-se. As rosas vão murchando. O que era doce acabou-se. As rosas vão murchando. O que era doce acabou-se. As rosas vão murchando.
Very lovely Brazilian tones there. And Fernando, you pronounced it so beautifully. I'll let you tell us what it was.
That was Você Não Ouviu by Chico Buarque.
You're very talented. Well, you've got the Brazilian front pages for us this morning.
I speak impressive Portuguese, you
You're
know?
Very good. Where shall we start today?
Shall we start with O Globo? Well, as you know, there's been new protests in Brazil, and there's a group of violent protesters called the Black Blocs, and they're on the cover here of O Globo because the police in Rio, they decided to be more kind of strict on them. And actually 70 of the 190 people who were arrested yesterday, they were indicted in a new law on organized crime, which means they can stay in jail for up to 8 years. And today, I mean, if you look at the front page, there's like some of those characters, of those people who were arrested.
And they're pretty high profile, aren't they?
Pretty high profile. There's a musician called Baiano, or Macunhão, which means big pothead.
Yeah, right. You can see. No guessing his leisure activities then.
Exactly. And you have as well cinema producer Elisa de Quadros, you know, who looks very angelic here, but actually, you know, she's...
And who's Rodrigo Azubel?
Rodrigo, actually, he's just a young guy. I mean, but he comes from a kind of upper middle class family as well. Okay. So
mini pothead.
But it's but it's interesting that at the same time in São Paulo, which there's been some protests as well, 60 people were arrested, but only one of them will be indicted. So there's been a very different reaction in both cities. Why in São Paulo they didn't want to arrest, and in Rio they said, you know what, we have to.
And that comes down to the local authorities, does it?
That comes down to the local authorities as well. I wonder if they did in Rio because, you know, they're worried about those big events that are coming, and this group, Black Blocs, already said that they're going to disrupt the World Cup next year. So, because, you know, of course, I understand that the protests are happening in Brazil, but this group is particularly, well, they're kind of vandals, you know. Even on the cover of Globo de São Paulo say that 70 vandals went to prison. This is not just kind of right-wing talk. They are really, they burning cars everywhere, you know, and sometimes they don't have reason for that because, as I said, usually they're high-profile people like musicians or cinema producers, you know, people maybe who are not that scared of the police, you know.
What's their point? What do they want, though? Why are they doing this?
Well, to be honest, there is a lack of... we don't know exactly what they want. Of course, they say, I want better education, better health, but it's very abstract, in a way, what they want. So... yeah, it's an interesting...
Well, Fernando, another story which has reached both O Globo and Folha de São Paulo for us.
Yeah, I was just reading these two little stories and I thought it worth mentioning that, you know, first of all, the Senate in Brazil yesterday, they approved a polemic law in which the mothers can register the kids with the surname of the father, even without his consent. So basically, it's clearly the law giving more, I would say, power to the woman, you know, to choose, you know, because sometimes... you know, fathers, they clearly have a kid, but then they don't want to register or something. But now the mothers have this right as well. And at the same time, again, something good for women as well is that the mayor of São Paulo, Fernando Haddad, he just approved a new law called authorizing humanizing birth in public hospitals. And what does he mean with that? Basically, it's going to be the use of anesthesia will be obligatory during a birth. And the pregnant woman as well, she can choose someone to be with her in the room where she's gonna have the baby. Anyone she wants.
Do you mean that all people giving birth have to have an anesthetic, or can you choose not? Because I know a lot of women would choose actually to do it completely naturally with no drugs whatsoever.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so. I think if you really want for personal reasons, you don't need to use anesthetics. But it's good that they have the option for it.
Phil's harking back to Mr. Pothead there. That's how he would like to give birth.
I'm dreaming. Fernando, a growing controversy regarding a very famous singer in the country, Caetano Veloso.
Exactly. Well, there's a big controversy in Brazil at the moment. All the literary communities commenting on that, various personalities as well. Basically, Caetano Veloso, which is one of our most famous singers, he went to court saying that he doesn't want his non-authorized biography to be published. And in Brazil, the law is quite strict on that. So usually probably he's going to win the case, which he didn't yet. And because Brazil is more or less like France when it comes to privacy. You know, it's not like here in the UK where everything's published on the papers. And in a way, even though a lot of people criticize the media here in the UK, I mean, I kind of like that it's very open and everything. But in Brazil, not really. I mean, if you're a powerful a musician or a politician, probably your secrets will be hidden forever somehow. Yeah. And it's interesting because singer Chico Buarque, which we just listened, his beautiful song, he was defending Caetano Veloso, saying that, yeah, I mean, he's right. I mean, why does this biography full of lies will be published? But at the same time, his sister, Ana Holanda Buarque, which is a former culture minister, said, actually, you know, I'm the daughter of a historian, so I can't agree with the prohibition of a biography.
Well, that's a fascinating story, Fernando. Unfortunately, we're going to leave it there. Many thanks to our producers, Annabel Bly, and our researchers, of course, Fernando Gomes Pacheco and Harriet Thorpe, and our studio manager, Bill Luti. Up next, after the news, is Culture with Rob Bound. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York. And don't forget, Aperitivo is on at 1800 hours London time as well. Marcus Hippie and Victoria Graham will be here for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.